it's now crystal clear that this was an industry-wide issue, and even and arguably especially the most law-abiding companies were targeted by this. It was a shoot the stallion to scatter the herd strategy.
Welcome into episode 11 of This Week in Bitcoin, and things have changed. It's 180 in just nearly 24 hours. Things are different now, and I'll get into the three big things that have shifted that may be bringing Operation Chokepoint 2.0 to an almost complete halt. I don't know if we'll go as far as to say completely over, but things really shifted today. Today in particular, as I record, for the entire crypto industry. We also hit the 90-day mark for the Bitcoin ETFs. That was on Tuesday. This is going to be relevant later in the show. And BlackRock's Bitcoin ETF is the sixth largest ETF fund in the world, only beaten by like the index funds for like the S&P 500. But I think what we're going to be talking about maybe for the next year or so is the shift that happened just in the last 24, 48 hours. Behind the scenes, for just about every moment since the FTX collapse, the White House has been orchestrating and leading Operation Chokepoint 2.0, along with Gary Gensler, Elizabeth Warren, and others that we'll discuss here in a moment. And they have been squeezing the industry, just like was done during the Obama administration for other industries. The Biden administration has been squeezing the crypto industry, stifling innovation, enforcement by regulation. And I have dozens upon dozens upon dozens of examples of this. But I have a very recent one from yesterday. Caitlin Long revealed under testimony to the Wyoming legislator that the White House orchestrated the anti-crypto efforts behind the scenes. Now, Caitlin, she's from Custodia Bank, and this is a fascinating story that you should look into. But let's just say she has the chops. She has been in this for years, deep into this legal fight, fighting the White House, fighting the Federal Reserve, and trying to do Bitcoin custody in a 100% backed way that businesses could count on. And in her testimony to the Select Committee on Blockchain, she specifically said that the White House coordinated attacks behind the scenes.
Point six. Multiple insiders came forward to tell us that the White House orchestrated the hit on the digital asset industry, including the denial of custodia. And one insider gave us the name of the White House official who coordinated it. A few days later, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin attacked custodia by name on the U.S. Senate floor. No one at custodia has ever met either that White House official or Senator Durbin. This was all political and all coordinated.
And she gets into some of that coordination and who's involved.
There were a lot of details that this person shared and direct knowledge of what happened. And there were a couple of others who put other puzzle pieces together. But here was the punchline. What they alleged is that this White House official locked arms with Marty Gruenberg at the FDIC and Gary Gensler at the SEC. And they decided to make the aggressive move against crypto after FTX, that the pro-crypto elements of the Biden White House had been, for various reasons, there was a power vacuum. Some folks had left. There was a transition for others to other jobs. And all of a sudden, there was this vacuum and this White House official locked arms with those two people. Marty Gruenberg has been in the news a lot lately. He just yesterday announced that he will be stepping down as FDIC chair. What is interesting about that is he is known as Chokepoint Marty. Marty Gruenberg is the person who started the original Operation Chokepoint.
Chokepoint Marty, chair of the FDIC, who's recently been embattled for a hostile workplace towards women and was protected by Elizabeth Warren and her team of former staffers. He was a central point of Operation Chokepoint.
Known as Chokepoint Marty. Marty Gruenberg is the person who started the original Operation Chokepoint, and he got confirmed to be chair of the FDIC.
He's now announced he's stepping down. He's not stepped down yet, but this just happened a few days ago. And everything that's happened since is in the wake of Choke Point Marty, as they say, announcing he was stepping down.
So he's back in that seat and he's at it again. Now, what will happen now that he's announced he will no longer be FDIC chair? How long will he stay there? How long will it take for the Senate to get someone else confirmed? He said he's stepping down as soon as his replacement comes in. We don't know. But so you notice that among those three names I just named, the Fed's not there. That was the point. The Fed was perceived in this scrum, according to this insider, to be pro-crypto. And they went first in what is now clearly an all-of-government coordinated crackdown on the industry. It was very confusing to us at the time because we thought it was about us. And we couldn't believe all of the heavy-handed tactics, including the intimidation, using the press to try to get us to withdraw. They really just wanted us to go away. I mean, literally, that is in the discovery.
They saw that in the documents. They just wanted them to go away. They were following all the rules. It was really pesky. Awful. And Custodia has been at the front of this fight. And then on May 22nd, 2024, something shifted. In fact, JP Morgan's Emily Choi, the president and chief operating officer, said, quote, "The tone from the SEC has just literally changed overnight." Quote, "The administration is sensing some panic." And then in the morning, the White House released a policy statement saying that they wanted to come to common sense regulation around digital assets, that they would no longer veto certain legislation, that they didn't necessarily support the legislation, but they wouldn't veto it. And they said they want a productive framework to promote digital assets. It's a huge shift. And yes, Senator Warren's probably still out there fighting, but she just lost the White House and she's losing the FDIC. And we'll talk about the third pillar of all of this, which is Gary Gensler and the SEC, who's also losing perhaps some of his bite. So why? Why are we seeing this huge shift? It's such a 180 that we've gone from the SEC maybe going after Consensus and the Ethereum Foundation and suing them for securities fraud. We've gone from that's their current course to a complete 180. And now it appears that we're going to get an ETH ETF.
Welcome back, everybody. We're watching crypto prices as Ethereum continues to rise on optimism that regulators could soon approve a spot ETF. The first of a series of decisions on the crypto instruments by the SEC are due tomorrow and Friday. The previous consensus was that they would not be approved, but you have seen the big jump as that consensus changed. 3,742, that's the last tick for Ethereum.
Ethereum was on the ropes, too. The community was talking about how Solana was kicking its butt. It looked like the ETF is fun to say, only had about a 25% chance of passing. Ethereum was on the ropes. So something changed. Something big shifted. Now, for some reason, to realign the Biden White House and to realign the Congress critters. But I'm sure it has nothing to do with some related news.
In other crypto news, the Trump campaign announced yesterday that it will start accepting crypto donations. The campaign said that donors can use any cryptocurrency accepted through the Coinbase Commerce product. It's the latest effort by the Trump campaign to try and court that crypto community.
The Coinbase Commerce product is absolute crap, by the way. But it is interesting that as of a week ago or so, when the Trump campaign said, yeah, fine, crypto, whatever, there has been a legitimate shift in the Democrats' stance towards crypto. I mean, it is obvious. I'll get into more.
I am sensing a widespread shift.
This is Mike Novogratz. Not a huge fan of his necessarily, but I think he makes some sense in this clip on CNBC.
I am sensing a widespread shift amongst Democrats that don't want to let crypto be a big election issue, right? The crypto super PACs have raised over $150 million, and they've targeted Sherrod Brown and John Tester, you know, elections that matter dearly to Democrats in swing states, in vulnerable Senate seats. Crypto should be bipartisan. And quite frankly, for our industry to do well, it needs to be bipartisan. And it has been really Elizabeth Warren, right, and a small group of people that has kind of held the Democrats hostage on this. And what the Senate broadly said, Chuck Schumer, you know, being the Senate leader who voted to overturn against Elizabeth, was enough, enough. Like, this is becoming dumb.
And I really can't necessarily overstate this, because it's not just, oh, we might get an ETH ETF for better or for worse. Oh, the Biden White House just released a policy statement saying they're not going to veto legislation, and they want to work with Congress. Yeah, that's noteworthy. But I think what is even more telling is actually what the Congress critters do. And after sitting around dead for like ever, the House got off its butt today and passed the Financial Innovation and Technology for the 21st Century Act.
Or as it's known for short, FIT21. This legislation, which House Financial Services Chair Patrick McHenry has been pushing for the better part of a year, would establish the Commodities Future and Trading Commission as the leading regulator of digital assets. There would be clear divisions for what the CFTC will regulate and what would fall under the purview of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which has vehemently cracked down on the crypto industry with a litany of enforcement actions. This legislation would also establish consumer protections and bar the sort of commingling of customer funds that played a role in the undoing of the crypto exchange FTX back in 2022.
That's actually a pretty big change. That would be a pretty significant change. It's sort of like the Swan model, although now they mine Bitcoin. That's not quite the model anymore. And the idea would be that if you're the broker, you can't also be the holder of the asset, so you have a little bit more protection there as a consumer.
Now, Republican lawmakers say this legislation will bring clarity for the crypto industry, but most Democrats, led by House Financial Services Committee Ranking Member Maxine Waters, oppose the bill. Waters warns the bill would effectively deregulate most crypto by removing them from the purview of the SEC.
Now, ironically, Maxine Waters, not wrong here. Even though, you know, we have video of her blowing kisses at Sam Altman and she was one of the direct beneficiaries of his lobbying, she's not wrong. The bill would exclude blockchain recorded investment contracts from the statutory definition of securities, and hence the protection that federal security laws provide. And there are some significant ones to the purchaser. The bill would also allow companies to self-certify that they are issuing digital commodities and not securities, and then give the SEC 60 days to determine if it's actually true or not. But there's nothing in the bill that gives the SEC more staff to review these things. They just have a 60-day window to object now. And that, I don't think, is a good thing. A lot of these, all of these really, except for Bitcoin, maybe a couple of others, are probably securities, if you really go by the Howey test. And this just kind of does away with that. It dramatically reduces the SEC's power. And it probably means that we're going to just sort of consider these cryptos not securities for the most part. And I don't necessarily think that's a good thing for consumers. But so she's got a point there. I mean, I'm not generally a Maxine Waters fan, but she's right there.
In a rare rebuke, SEC Chair Gary Gensler put out a lengthy statement this morning on the legislation saying, quote, it would create new regulatory gaps and undermine decades of precedent regarding the oversight of investment contracts, putting investors and capital markets at immeasurable risk. The House expected to vote on this legislation around 5 p.m. this afternoon, where it is expected to pass the chamber, largely thanks to support from Republicans and a handful of Democrats.
Now, what's unusual about this, not just the fact that this thing's been sitting around for like a year and gone nowhere, then all of a sudden, boom, it's been picked up, is that it has an unusual amount of support. This is Sheila Warren, not Elizabeth Warren, but Sheila Warren. She's the CEO of like the Crypto Council for Innovation, one of the lobbying groups. But I cut her down. And I thought this moment she shared was interesting.
But in our view, this does have bipartisan support. Hmm. We are seeing an unprecedented collaboration between the Ag Committee, the Financial Services Committee, and a true bipartisan push from many folks across the aisle to get this thing across the line, particularly in the House.
And she's not wrong. Right before I recorded, the House voted. And it passed 279 to 136 votes.
On this vote, the yeas are 279 and the nays are 136. The bill is passed.
And 71 House Democrats voted yay for it. So they came together with Republicans to pass this thing. So you have the leader of Operation Choke Point 2.0 essentially losing his position because Liz and her army couldn't protect him. You have the Biden White House making a politically calculated pivot on crypto. And you have the House with Republicans and Democrats coming together to pass FIT 21, which dramatically reduces Gary and the SEC's power. And of course, it's the election.
I think, you know, people vote or don't vote for many reasons. OK, and I do think that crypto holders tend to be voters. And so when we have actually polled likely voters, so we don't poll just like every, you know, random Tom, Dick and Harry, we poll likely voters and overwhelmingly they are in favor of crypto regulation here in the United States.
And I believe that the Biden White House in particular lives and dies on these kind of opinion polling. Everything they say, all of their political messaging really is measured in polls. And the polling shows that the people who are crypto owners tend to, on average, be a single issue voter. And that is, do you or do you not support crypto?
At the federal level. So when you consider the fact that you've got a huge swath of American from across the parties, from Republicans, Democrats, Independents, over 20% are ownership of crypto, digital wallets. This is an innovation that is, as Tom Emmer has said, we're in the digital age and we're only moving there faster and faster. So when you look at younger demographics, when you look at people of color, when you look at rural versus urban, there's not a real divide in terms of who's looking to digital assets, who owns them and who holds them. Now, again, people vote for many reasons. But I do think that crypto and the lack of movement on crypto regulation gets a lot of airtime and not just from the industry. And I think people are very frustrated by that. They want to be able to access these assets. They want to know they're doing it in a safe and sound way. They want to know that they're being protected. And they want American companies building in this space. So the answers are very clear in my mind. And that's the reason you're seeing so much, I would argue, outsized attention being paid to this one area.
And here's what it tells us. It tells us that since the collapse of FTX, the Biden White House has been on a campaign to take something away from the people that could improve the lives of the middle class for political reasons. They clearly had no conviction on this issue. My generous interpretation of why they have orchestrated Operation Chokepoint 2.0 and then turned on a dime, as the polling showed they should, is not because of any strategic reason outside of potentially stalling and making the crypto industry less competitive to give time for a CBDC to enter the market and be competitive. But that's such a long shot goal that's clearly ill-defined and hard to measure. I could see that being something they could give up on pretty quickly if the campaign polling shows this is becoming an issue for them. It also exposes Gary as a political actor. If he can turn the SEC on a dime from going full lawsuit, securities lawsuit against Ethereum, to potentially approving it. And it implicates the Fed, according to the testimony we heard, has been coordinating with the White House, and senators, and the FDIC chair. So the Fed's been acting politically. These are all really awful things that this celebrates, that this exposes. And I'm not trying to celebrate any kind of, I'm not celebrating FIT 21. That's what I was trying to say. I'm not trying to celebrate it here. It's only passed the House. It still has to go through the Senate. And I'm not actually all that positive. It's a very good thing for Bitcoin long term. But I do think this is fascinating what this all exposes. And of course, there is one other element, and that's the money, as Strike's Jack Mahlers points out.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of any other cryptocurrency outside of Bitcoin, but I think there is a hilarious story as to why this is happening. I mean, I was laughing out loud. It looks like someone went to Gary Gensler and said, hey, buddy, you're not in charge anymore. And you'd have to think why that was. It's because banks and Wall Street are making money, right? Banks get a really bad deal in today's market as they have to buy bonds that are performing awfully. And all of a sudden, they get a free market in this independent crypto thing, and they're actually making money. These markets have life. These markets go up. When governments debase their currency, these things perform well. And they got a taste of Bitcoin, and it was the best performing product that they've ever had. And they're like, oh man, how many other pieces of crap are there out there that we can list as ETFs? And I literally think that's what's happening. It's a way better business to launch crypto ETFs than it is to buy bonds right now. Based on the macro environment. So I think someone said, hey, Gary, sorry, buddy, despite you thinking that these things are securities, we need to make money. And that's what happened.
Yep, there's a money angle to it. There's a money angle. And I'm not sure if the passing of an Ethereum ETF is going to be good for Bitcoin. I think it could confuse the public And most of them will likely lump the Bitcoin and ETFs to ETH ETFs together. And I think Ethereum's fundamentals still suck. You know, what's the supply cap? When's the protocol finished? These things, not great for an investment. These questions just kind of lingering out there, not great. And it's also not clear to me that a staking proof of stake chain will make for a good ETF product. You know, if it's an ETF, that which it looks like right now by the SEC's rules, what we've seen leaked so far is that there can be no staking. So if it's an ETF that does not stake, well, that's a massive opportunity cost for both the ETF holder and issuer. The ETF holder also is going to be paying a fee for that account to get managed and missing out on the staking rewards. So that's a double loss on the Ethereum ETF. And if the ETFs can have staking, well, then that staking is going to be managed by the ETF vendor like Coinbase or BlackRock. Well, congratulations. Right now, these guys are going to be huge. And the governance of the blockchain is now going to be in the hands of BlackRock or Coinbase, who are regulated by the U.S. government and enforce KYC and OFAC compliance. So you're screwed if you don't have staking, and you're screwed if you do have staking. An ETF based off of a proof of work product like Bitcoin doesn't have these problems at all. So the two ETFs are not going to be similar products, but they will be sold and bought and talked about as if they are. And, you know, when one gets mentioned, the other one's going to get mentioned. So I'm not super enthusiastic about these changes. I think, you know, it is probably good for digital assets overall, and it may just mean that they have to fight it out on a larger market scale, on a different time scale. You know, I think it would have been better if they could have lived in this little crypto corner of the world for a while and let all the kind of crap coins die off for a bit, or at least most of them, especially like the VC-created ones that are backed by a group and a team and a leader. Let those die off. Then bring the remaining standing ones into the wider market would be, you know, if I had a magic wand. That's just not what we're going to see here. And so instead, we're going to watch it kind of play out with the wider financial market. We'll see how that goes. It does suggest a massive shift in the crypto voting bloc's political power, though. The fact that we're even here is incredible, and that it is an issue for both presidential candidates. I cannot express to you how amazing that is as somebody who has been in Bitcoin forever. I can't believe Bitcoin has become a presidential political issue. I guess I expected that in another decade. I don't know. But to me, it's remarkable to see it. And to see them fighting for loyalty to that market. It's a really incredible development. And then to see the Congress critters turn on a dime so fast. I find the entire situation incredibly fascinating. And it's really just heating up. Now, FIT21, you know, their version has to go through the Senate. It's got to go to Biden's desk. We also have, of course, the potential approval of an Ethereum ETF and the ramifications of what that might mean for the wider market. So we're really just at the very beginning here. But man, if it really just hasn't been a couple of wild weeks. All right, I have a question for you. Boost in with your answer. Americans are holding onto their cars historically longer than they ever have in modern history. And I think there's a macroeconomic angle, and I think particularly there's a Bitcoin angle. I'm going to play this clip for you so you get the background, and then I'll ask the question.
The average age of vehicles in the United States reaching an all-time high. Phil LeBeau joins us with more right now. Hey, Phil, what's the story?
Becky, take a look at this chart, because this is a snapshot of the American vehicles that are out on the road right now. And you're seeing that vehicles are now at an all-time high in terms of the average age, 12.6 years, according to S&P Global Mobility. And again, they've never been higher than this. Three things are driving this. First of all, the reliability of vehicles built after 2000. It's not uncommon now to see a 2011, let's say, RAV4 that's out on the road and still running very well. You've also got new vehicle prices close to a record high. Add in high financing costs, high insurance costs, and a lot of people are saying, you know what? I'm good with what I'm driving right now.
All right. I think those are definitely factors. I think the reasons he just laid out there, you know, the rates, the cost, definitely factors. But I don't think that's the complete story. Boost in and tell me what you think is the complete reason. Why is the average American car on the road right now 12 years old?
And there's also slow EV adoption has many potential buyers in a wait and see mode.
I think there's still a lot of wait and see on if you want to jump into the electric market or kind of wait to see how the infrastructure and everything develops.
And that's the key. There are many people who say, I'd like to go electric at some point. Not entirely comfortable with that at this point. Here's a breakdown of the average ages and these three buckets here. The thing to focus on here, 6 to 15 is the sweet spot for do-it-yourself repair, if you will, or keeping that vehicle going on the road and going to an auto parts retailer.
40% of the cars on the road in the States right now are 6 to 15 years old. And 30% of them are older than 16 years. That's remarkable. I just, to me, that is, if you look at all the different data, like, you know, they cook the CPI, they can cook the unemployment numbers, you know, the market can do this, inflation can do that. But that kind of data, I think that truly gives you insight into the state of the consumer. And I'd like you to boost in and tell me what insights you glean from that. And I think that could make for a really fun feedback and boost segment. All right, we have a lot more to get to. Your boosts, an important new initiative to protect peer-to-peer rights, and a couple of must-reads I want to tell you about. But first, I want to thank Podhome.fm, my podcasting 2.0 hosting platform that has all the podcasting 2.0 features you might like or want. Transcripts, chapters, clips, live streams, and it's powered by Podhome AI, which can auto-generate your chapters, suggest titles and descriptions. And there's been a beautiful update to the analytics. You can now see unique listeners over time, so you can see how many people listen to your episode. The dashboard just keeps getting better. And if you use the promo code TWIB, you can try out my podcasting 2.0 hosting platform of choice for 3 months for free. TWIB, 3 months for free at podhome.fm. That's a great deal and a great platform that just keeps getting better and better. Thank you to Podhome.fm for sponsoring This Week in Bitcoin. We really appreciate it. All right, we have some boosts, and our baller booster comes in from Nat Gas Immersion. Oh, okay. All right. Wonder what you're Nat Gas in. And it's 66,666 sats. Love it. I love it. And he says, thank you, sir. Pronunciation tip. Oh, yes. He says, you know, hummus, that's how you say lummus. Yes, not Loomis. I was saying Senator Loomis. You know what? You know what's funny about that Nat Gas? I finished recording the episode last week, and I said to myself, that's not how you say your name. I think it's, you know, I don't say it out loud very often, but I've heard it. And after the episode, I was like, why did I say it like that? But he goes, and I thank you. I appreciate your work. My friend Alicia Stockman got selected to be on the Bitcoin 2024 record vinyl, and she's relatively new to Value for Value. So please give her song a listen and boost it if you like. And he sends me the Wavelake link, and I will put that in the show notes as well if you'd like to give that Value for Value track a listen. The Podfather comes in with a row of McDucks, 22,222 sats.
Things are looking up for old McDuck. Yeah! This old duck still got it.
He says he's boosting for the gerbil energy. Sometimes I do get that. You know, running in that hamster wheel. Thank you, Podfather. Nice to hear from you. Keep up the great work. The Tone Wrecker comes in with 3,333 sats. He says, I appreciate the extra editing and clips you do in these intro episodes for context. Thank you for your efforts. Yeah, you know, the bulk of the work of this show is probably following the news, collecting the clips, trimming the clips. I kind of have this really, really low tolerance for clips that are longer than like 2 minutes or so. And even shorter is better. Like, so one of my clips today was 11 seconds. That is work, but you know, it's work that I'm happy to do if you guys get the value from it. So thank you for that boost, and thank you for acknowledging those efforts, Tone Wrecker. Really appreciate it. Jean Bean comes in with 4,444 sats. Pew, pew, pew. Everyday news shows and bloggers are what will likely convince people to believe in Bitcoin. Ah, answering my question, what's going to shift the normie opinion? Yeah, so when everyday vloggers and news shows, sure, I agree with that. Seeing Bitcoin approach the all highs from back in March just now has me excited to hear the next episode and maybe learn what's up. If you have any tips for places to look for the news about what's driving the price, I'd love to hear them. Well, Gene Bean, what drives the price can vary every single time the price gets driven. So there's nothing I could particularly point you at. But there are just fundamentals that I think are the absolute most bullish for this year that we've seen in a very long time. Now that we're through this halving, the daily production of Bitcoin is 450 Bitcoins. Yesterday, the ETFs bought over 4,000 Bitcoin in one day. So we produced 450, and in one day, they bought 4,000. That doesn't even count the plebs that are buying, you know, the DCA army that's stacking every single day, buying a little bit of Bitcoin, taking a little bit off the market. Just the ETFs bought 4,000 Bitcoin yesterday, as I record. There's a lot of fundamentals there that when it gets to the scarcity that I think look really good. So generally, what drives the price of Bitcoin is the overall liquidity of the market. When there is cash in the market, when liquidity is flowing, Bitcoin sucks it up like a black hole, like a perfectly technologically engineered money black hole. And when liquidity is tight in the market, maybe something changes in the macro environment, recession, you know, people get spooked by a war or some sort of crazy spike in oil, you'll see that people need to take profits. And that's why generally there's volatility in Bitcoin's price, is because Bitcoin is extremely liquid. And so when bad news breaks on the weekend or at 6 p.m. in the evening when the market's closed, you can sell your Bitcoin right away. And it's a $1 trillion market. So you can get quite a bit of money out real fast. You know, the banks will take days. If you know, imagine if something goes down on a Friday. There's some sort of world event that happens on a Friday. Well, if you want to get your money out of the bank, you're waiting until Monday. Better hope it's not a three-day weekend. But with Bitcoin, you get it right away. See, that's why you'll see the Bitcoin price run down sometimes when there's news. So you just kind of use this as a basic framework to look at what's going on, and then you can kind of graph that over what's going on with the Bitcoin price behavior. That's a rough model. I think my best tip would be listen to the show, because if you listen to everything I just talked about, you'll understand why the price has been going up this week. You know what I mean? Like, you just listen to what I just, all the stuff I just ran through. And then that kind of gives you insights into why we saw the price run up. Happens right there. Even if we don't mean to talk about price. Cannabis Records comes in with 4,200 sats.
B-O-O-S-T.
Thanks for spinning one of the retrograde tunes. We are Cannabis Records, the artist first indie rock label behind the retrograde. We believe Bitcoin is the answer. And we are here for the revolution. Yeah, brother. That is great. Thanks for reaching out, Cannabis Records. Great to hear from you. Absolutely fantastic. Keep up the good work. Oppie1984 comes in with 4,000 sats and just says, boost.
Boost.
Thank you, Oppie. Appreciate it. Crashmaster comes in with 2,000 sats. Maybe a special episode drops for non-news BTC features. Okay. Special. You know, I actually have been, I don't know, I've been considering special episodes more. Crashmaster. So your boost is very well timed. Thank you very much. Hybrid Sarcasm comes in with 2,000 sats. If I want to buy into the Bitcoin ETFs, where do I go to find out what they are and how they are performing? Bloomberg, Yahoo. Hybrid. It is funny. If you come at it from a Bitcoin first experience, and then you go try to interface with the ETF world, it's like, why? Where do I get the information? Like, it is so strange. Their stock tickers are available on, things like TradingView and whatnot. But generally, you have a broker. I was going to say an app, but actually, what's behind that is a brokerage. In modern days, you open up your banking app, and they've got an ETF section in there, or you log into their website. That's generally how you do it now. Because ETFs are bought and sold through your broker, there are stock tickers like iBit is BlackRock's. There's a bunch. And the way they do the pricing is funny. It makes it look cheap again. But you really would, you know, I'm not going to say don't buy the ETF, because there are some scenarios where I think a Bitcoin ETF makes sense if you're just trying to get price exposure. And you think you might want to use it as collateral in a loan. I think the Bitcoin ETF products are probably going to get that capability before those of us that hold Bitcoin in our own private wallets get the ability to, you know, use it as collateral for like a home loan. But what you don't get access to is the protection from the debasement, and, you know, or something much worse, really. I say debasement, but really what I mean is, because you do get some of that from the price action exposure, but really what you get protection from is like collapse of the dollar. You get access to being directly on the Bitcoin system, and you're owning a piece of this extremely scarce asset, and you're actually owning it. Whereas with the ETF, right, it's a paper thing, and you can sell it for cash only. And so what you're really doing is, at some point, you're just going to cash back out into the system, into the fiat casino. Now, that may make sense. Like, you know, if you wanted to put $5,000 into a Bitcoin ETF, sit on it for 3 years with the express intention of cashing out and using that cash to buy something, maybe it makes sense. Maybe it does. So it's, you know, it's up to each individual. Let me know just kind of what you think, Hybrid, and if you discover what works. Just kind of, I don't know, keep me posted on that journey at least as much as you're comfortable. Bullapera comes in with 5,000 sats. All right.
Coming in hot with the boost.
I'd like to hear your breakdown of the modern monetary theory stuff, but I don't really care if it's on the show or another one. Nice meeting you at Texas Linux Fest. Well, that's awesome. Nice to meet you there, too. Yeah, I think maybe if maybe I'll do a special. I don't know. You know, I started doing it, and I hate it so much. It melts my brain. It's so dumb. The whole thing is like they look at all of the liabilities that the federal government owns as also asset. Their whole premise is basically all the debt is also like our assets. And that the Federal Reserve also can count all of the citizens' assets on its balance sheet, which is bonkers. Where that leads to logically is asset forfeiture, seizure, and things like that. It's just bonkers. It just melts my brain. But I may still give it a go because I do think it helps explain the logic behind some of these politicians and the thinking behind some of these quote-unquote experts like Peter Zeihan, who said that Bitcoin was going to go to negative prices, and it's now up 350% since Peter ran his mouth. But he's a modern monetary theory guy. And so in his world, Bitcoin doesn't make sense because it's scarce, it's limited, it has a supply cap. That's just bonkers to him. Meanwhile, I'm over here thinking, it's crazy they can print unlimited amounts of money for the same money I have to work for. That seems bonkers to me. That's bonkers over here. Faraday Fedora comes in with Rowit Ducks. I think I agree with the review of finding the money doesn't fit the news show format, but you should still do it. Maybe a Bitcoin dad will want to get in on that. Oh, that'd be fun. And yes, our Canadian politicians, a true example of douche and turd sandwich dilemma. Yeah, I've been thinking about that Justin Trudeau clip all week. I've been thinking about it all week. It's one that I just want to keep in the bag and play from time to time, you know? Ace Ackerman comes in with Road Ducks. Value for Value, episode 10. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Halleck comes in with 10,000 sats. Woo, doggy.
I hoard that which your kind covet.
Fire episode, Chris. So much to respond to. On Wisconsin, I cringe to say it, but I think the attention coming from politics is the next needle mover. Let's see, you sent that on the 17th, Halleck, and you were damn right. You were damn right. That Mahler's clip was so good. Do you have a link to it? I think he basically dismantled the Keynesians. It only works if the deficit spending pays for itself through growth. Yep, that's the whole catch. I have another Jack clip I want to play. I know I play a lot of Jack clips, but he also gets a lot of airtime. The guy's smart, too. Sharp. I don't have a link for all of them, Halleck. So the way it works is if I can, I always link in the show notes at thisweekinbitcoin.show. However, sometimes I record these clips off of TV, and I don't really have a way to probably legally distribute that. If it's up on Twitter or it's on YouTube, it's like I'm just linking to that. That's one thing. But also, I just don't have a way to distribute like a bunch of FLAC files. I used to use BitTorrent Sync for that. Oh, God, it was great. Because I could post the episode in the root directory and then all the clips back in the day for Unfilter. Miss BitTorrent Sync. So, Halleck, when I can, I will totally try to link to that. Thank you for the boost. Golfwinch comes in with 6,777 sats. Oh, I like that number. I bet you there's a meaning there. I'm sorry I don't know it. Your show is insanely awesome, and I thank you for it. Well, Golf, you're insanely awesome. It's nice to hear from you. Thank you for the boost. User 61 came in with 2,100 sats. European stacking solutions for you all. Up, take note. We got a solution. Pocket Bitcoin or Reali. They both allow stacking over Lightning. Sats go directly to your own wallet. Reali is R-E-L-A-I. All right. We also have another one, another EU stacking tip. Thank you, User 61. Jin from Matik comes in with 4,000 sats.
Fun will now commence.
I'd like to recommend an app for EU Bitcoiners. The Reali app, R-E-L-A-I app, to buy Bitcoin in DCA with little or to no fees, or really low fees. No need to sign up. You can buy up to 1,000 euro per day or 100,000 per year without KYC. Holy crap! That's great. The only info so they need your CB or bank transfer IBAN number. Okay, well, that's kind of identifying information, but I guess not still the same. After some months, you can send it to all the cold storage wallet. You can send it to your cold storage wallet. Fees are only 1.5% if you have a friend affiliate code. You can use mine, and I earn 0.5%. The code, I will try to put that in the show notes. I'll try to put his referral code in the show notes. It's REL218932. That is sweet that you can do 1,000 per day without KYC or 100,000 per year. The Reali app, R-E-L-A-I. That is a great couple of recommendations. Thank you, Jen from Atik and User 61. I had no idea that even existed. This is why I am so grateful when I get information like that. Help spread the word and expand my knowledge, too. I'm a little jealous. That seems like a pretty good deal. The Golden Dragon came in with a small boosterini, but I wanted to cover it. He says, the way I have my stacking saving method is I get a direct deposit into Strike. I then swap into Liquid with Aqua. Then once that number of stack size is sufficient, I'll then cold store it with my seed signer. There you go. Says, I love the High Signal show. Thank you, Dragon. Appreciate the small boosterini. We do have a 2,000 sat cutoff to keep things tight on the show. But we had 20 boosters, and we stacked 143,361 sats. Not bad. Thank you, everybody. This show's about 2 days of work, so my goal is like around 200,000 sats. That doesn't really make it a very high payday for me, but, you know, I'm stacking for the future. So I'm willing to put the work in today, and I'm hoping if you get value, if it helps you think about Bitcoin, or maybe how you manage your stack or how you're going to approach your stack, maybe kick a little value back to the show with a boost. Go get a new podcast app at podcastapps.com, and then you can boost any. Now, you can also boost from Fountain.fm's website with any Lightning-enabled app, so you don't even have to switch podcast apps. I think you should, because this is a podcasting 2.0 fully compliant show, which means you get transcripts, you get chapters, you get value splits when I play music. And in the future, when we do live events, that's also just going to show right up there in the app. So I do really recommend you go get a new podcasting 2.0 app at newpodcastapps.com. All right, let's move right along. I wanted to let you know about p2prights.org. This was announced this week. It's the Peer-to-Peer Rights Fund. Their mission is to safeguard the decentralized peer-to-peer integrity of the Bitcoin ecosystem by defending non-custodial tools and the developers who create them. This was announced by David Zell, the co-founder of the Bitcoin Policy Institute. They say the P2P Rights Fund will provide resources to subsidize defense counsel and sponsor amicus briefs in pivotal cases, support and finance affirmative impact legislation to secure crucial legal precedents, and will offer free or subsidized regulatory advice to developers and non-custodial Bitcoin tools. And the fund's first undertaking is the defense of the recently indicted Samurai Wallet developers. Huge, guys. Huge. So, and I believe you can make a tax write-off donation as well. P2PRights.org. Really excited to see that. Very good news. We'll be right back. I've got two great links that are going to put smiles on your face to read after the show. I could do a whole episode on either one of these articles. Number one, this man did not invent Bitcoin. The New York Times did a savage takedown of fake Toshi. Now that the judge brief has come out and there is strong language in there about what a liar and a faker Craig Wright was, nobody's holding back. And even the New York Times wrote a piece about it. I have an archive.org link if you'd like to read that. And then, I can't believe I'm saying this, but Forbes, of all places, has a great article that ties Ripple's anti-Bitcoin campaign and all of the ESG FUD and all of that to Ripple's eventual promotion of CBDCs. And it's chef's kiss. It is a great takedown of one of Bitcoin's most active critics out there in a professional, well-documented way. I can't believe I'm seeing it from Forbes. Two great links. This man did not invent Bitcoin, and Ripple's anti-Bitcoin campaign to promote CBDCs will be linked up in the show notes. There is still so much going on, even this week as I record. I thought about delaying the show, but here's what I'm going to do instead. I'm just going to keep an eye on how things develop. And if it's called for, I'm going to just break into the feed with a special episode. But depending on the news, I also might just let things play out for a few days. And then I'll just cover everything in the next week's episode. So your best bet is go get subscribed to the show if you haven't yet. Things are really just beginning to heat up, and it's anybody's guess now that it's a political issue. So go grab a podcast app like Fountain FM or Podverse or any of the great apps at podcastapps.com. And maybe consider sharing the show with somebody who's Bitcoin curious. Send them over to thisweekinbitcoin.show so they can get started. And I'd also love it if you boosted in. Let me know what you'd like to hear from the show. Now, like I mentioned, this is a podcasting 2.0 show, and I like to feature a little value for value music. So the next track I play, if you boost in while that music is playing, your sats will go to that artist and whoever they put in their splits. And it's creating a new community of artists who are directly publishing their music and directly getting value from the audience. It's really an awesome movement, and it's fascinating to watch these artists embrace this idea even faster than podcasters. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll wrap it up with Element Zero by Real Richard.
That is basically what Satoshi found when he discovered Bitcoin. You can view it as an element without protons or neutrons. So this is an element without mass. The information about the element is the element, since it's a purely informational element.
Allows the individual to shield his efforts from the state's malevolence, and we're able to build on the base layer of humanity's latest element, Bitcoin.